I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Over the millennia, natural forces have caused mass extinctions five times, including the infamous asteroid that wiped out dinosaurs millions of years ago. But journalist Elizabeth Colbert says a new destructive force is threatening the tenuous balance of nature. As the comic strip philosopher Pogo once said, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." In a provocative new book called The Sixth Extinction, Elizabeth Colbert argues that we're in a new age of mass extinctions caused by humans putting more pressure on nature than it can take. Worldwide, she says, humans have become the asteroid now. Can we stop a chain of extinctions that could end with us? Elizabeth Colbert on Midday after the news. And welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Have you ever heard of the great auk? It's a bird, or I should say it was a bird, that looked a lot like the penguin, large and flightless and virtually defenseless against humans who discovered hundreds of thousands of them lining the shores of Newfoundland, Iceland, and other northern beaches. Prized for their meat, eggs, and feathers, they were gone for good by 1844. When Icelandic hunters strangled the last one. If this were an isolated case of overkill, our next guest might be less worried about the future of the planet. But journalist Elizabeth Colbert says this was just one early warning sign that a single species is threatening to tip the balance of nature past the point of natural healing. That species is us. Elizabeth Colbert argues that over the last 500 million years or so, there have been five major mass extinctions, when enough species were wiped out entirely to significantly reduce the diversity of life on Earth. These were all natural. The most spectacular occurred 66 million years ago when an asteroid struck and kicked up a dust cloud that reduced sunlight enough to wipe out most dinosaurs and a host of other species, too. But in a provocative and highly readable new book called The Sixth Extinction, Elizabeth Colbert argues that we've reached another crossroads of mass extinction, only this one is caused by us. Humans, she argues, are unique among animals in being able to change the planet. We've already transformed as much as a half of its land surface. We've diverted rivers, dumped acid into the ocean, produced greenhouse gases that are warming the Earth and raising ocean levels. Just as importantly, she says, humans are moving species around the planet, in ships, in planes, even in our clothes when we return home from vacations. Some of those invasive species can crowd out or devour others, such as the pythons, descendants of pet snakes set loose in Florida's Everglades, where they've decimated the small animal population. From the limestone caves of Vermont to the shores of Iceland, to the Amazon and the Andes and the Great Barrier Reef of Australia, Elizabeth Colbert documents these disturbing changes. She tells tales of endangered bats and tree frogs and even crows who have to be sexually aroused by San Diego zookeepers. Is there any way to stop these incipient mass extinctions and the man-made forces that have brought us to the tipping point? Elizabeth Colbert, a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine and distinguished environmental advocate, will give us her thoughts on that in this hour of Midday. Her first book was Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, and her latest, available from Henry Holt, is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Elizabeth Colbert, welcome to Midday in Baltimore. It's a pleasure to have you on the show with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
And thank you for this excellent book. I wonder, the book has been out for a little while now, so I wonder if you could share with us what the reaction has been. I know that it's been critically acclaimed, excellent reviews of it, but I wonder, as you move about and talk to different people, what do they say about The Sixth Extinction?
Well, the response has been really overwhelmingly positive, and I suppose as an author, you never know whether that's a self-selective group, you know, the people who come up to you after book signings.
Yeah.
Or the people who even bother to show up at your book signings, how's that? So I don't want to say I've taken sort of a random survey, but I've been really surprised and gratified by the response it's gotten so far.
If people kind of accept that this is the truth, now the next question is, what do we do about it?
Well, I think, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that everyone is aware. You can barely open the papers, without once a week, once a month, finding some story about a species that's in terrible trouble, that's on the brink. Sometimes it's a species that's just been discovered, and we discover there's one tiny population that's on the brink. There were just a spate of articles recently, for example, about a new snail, a new kind of snail even, that was found in Southeast Asia on these limestone cliffs that are now being quarried. So the snail is immediately classified as endangered because its whole habitat is being lost. And I think people hear this kind of drip, drip, drip of this news, and when you put it all together, which was really sort of the point of the book, they realize, yeah, something really big is going on right now.
And we're going to talk about some of the really big things that happened previously, the previous five extinctions that the title of your book refers to and the one underway now. But before we get into the causes and effects of those extinctions, Elizabeth, one of the most interesting things I learned from your book is that it was only recently, really, in terms of humanity, that we even understood the notion of extinction. So let's talk a little bit about that, our understanding of extinction.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, to appreciate how radical an idea this was, you don't have to go back very far. You only have to go back as far as the time of the colonists and the time of the American Revolution and the time of Thomas Jefferson, who was very, very interested in natural history. And one of the interesting things that happened as the Europeans settled North America and South America is they found some pretty extraordinary fossils that were quite close to the surface of the earth. They're not even really technically fossils, they're sort of sub-fossils. And one tr very big find was made in upstate New York. It was a mastodon, a very intact mastodon skeleton. And Thomas Jefferson heard about this, and he was very excited. He wanted to obtain it. If you look in his collected letters, he writes to people who live in the Hudson Valley. It was found in the Hudson Valley. He says, "Please try to go get this mastodon. I really want it." He didn't know it was a mastodon. He just thought it was, some beast. It didn't have a name at that point. He does not get it, but his friend, who's the artist Charles Wilson Peale, does manage to get his hands on it. And there's a very famous painting called "The Exhumation of the Mastodon" by Peale of this. It was sort of like a fair. Everyone showed up to dig up this mastodon. And it ended up in Peale's museum, and it's been sort of described as the first blockbuster exhibit in American history. So anyway, when Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out to the American Northwest, he was still part of this very long-standing tradition since the beginning of humanity, really, that everything that we saw traces of, all the animals that we saw traces of, must be out there somewhere, right? The creator would not create a beast only to do away with it. And so Jefferson explicitly, thinks that we're going to find mastodons. Lewis and Clark are going to find live mastodons roaming around the American Northwest. And then this French naturalist named Georges Cuvier, who's really a towering figure, although he's been somewhat forgotten, comes along, excuse me. And he says, pretty simply, it wasn't a really very, very sophisticated, act of scientific research. It was a deduction, basically. He said, look, if there are animals that large out there, we would have seen them. That animal is gone.
Right.
And he is the first person to really theorize, if you could give it such a highfalutin term, extinction. And he decides that there's a whole lost world. And he goes out to find this lost world, traces of this lost world, and very, very soon and very successfully starts finding lots and lots of animals that are clearly extinct. People send him drawings from all around Europe. He gives the mastodon its name eventually, he gives the pterodactyl its name. He was a very smart guy. He also realized that there had been an age of giant reptiles. He realized that all the way back in the beginning of the 19th century.
So here we are. This is the late 18th century, Georges Cuvier, and he's concluding that these bones belong to a lost species from a lost world, a world previous to ours. And that's really sort of how extinction evolved as a scientific concept from then on, I guess.
Yeah, and he the concept has sort of an interesting and twisty history, which is really the first part of the book, because Cuvier believes this is pre-evolution, right? And Cuvier is very opposed to the idea of evolution, which is floating around already in the form being espoused in a form by one of his colleagues in Paris, Lamarck, who's, very famous too. He has kind of a somewhat mystical account of evolution that, is no longer is not given any credence today in scientific terms, but he was really one of the very first people to be pushing this idea that species transform. And Cuvier found that ridiculous, and he was very dismissive of it, very mean to Lamarck, actually. He wasn't the nicest guy. And he thought that animals went extinct in these great waves. They only went extinct when the world changed, and he called these revolutions on the surface of the earth. And then Darwin comes along, and he says that's ridiculous, that species go extinct when new species evolve and outcompete them. It's a very, very slow process. It happens very gradually. There are no such things as these global catastrophes. And Darwin is such an impressive and important figure, obviously, in science, that theory holds sway for a very long time. And people are embarrassed even when they find evidence in the fossil record that there have been actually these moments of mass extinction. They sort of brush over them because it's considered kind of taboo to think that way.
So science has concluded that there were five of these mass extinctions, one dating back maybe 450 million years. The one that gets all the attention, Elizabeth, is the extraterrestrial one, right? These five previous extinctions were from natural causes, or the one was extraterrestrial. That takes us back about 65 or 66 million years.
Right, that's a biggie. I
Yeah.
mean, and it looms very large in our imaginations, and this is really the extinction, the discovery of that asteroid impact, which was only really confirmed in the early 90s, so 20 years or so ago, really has revived this idea that catastrophic change is possible. We have had these moments of very wrenching change on Earth when many, many, many species have gone extinct. And in some cases the cause is somewhat obscure, and in some cases it seems fairly clear what it is, though it's often hard to know exactly why. The event happened in the asteroid. We know an asteroid collided with Earth. It was a very large asteroid. It was about 6 miles across. We know there where the crater is. It was buried under sediments in the Gulf of Mexico, and it did in not just the dinosaurs did not survive that. A lot of other groups, the pterosaurs didn't survive it, the mosasaurs didn't survive it, the ammonites, which were these great sea creatures that were a bit like nautiluses, didn't survive it. Most mammals didn't survive it. Most birds didn't survive it. Most reptiles didn't survive it. It was a very devastating event.
We'll take a short break here and come back and continue our conversation with Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, distinguished science journalist, whose latest book is The Sixth Extinction, an Unnatural History. Her title refers to five geological periods defined by mass extinctions that significantly reduced the diversity of life on Earth. And the sixth, which is going on now and is caused by one particular species, humans. This is Midday on WYPR. Dan Rodericks. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday, Dan Rodericks. We have the pleasure of the company this hour of Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, whose latest book is called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. It's published by Henry Holt. And Elizabeth, in the book, you offer a list of, I would say, there are three factors that we need to talk about in terms of what man is doing to encourage mass extinction. And I made notes here of PTA, population, technology, and arrogance. I think that's about right, isn't it? Why don't we talk about each then? First, population.
Well, absolutely, population of humans has really been, expanding at. E.O. Wilson has described it as more bacterial than primate. When Georges Cuvier was around at the turn of the from the 18th to 19th century, there were maybe 1 billion people on the planet, and today there are 7.2 billion people. We're going to hit 8 billion in about a decade or so. So we're heading up to 9, 10. It's not clear exactly where we're going to get. So there are a lot of us, and each one of us has an impact, though obviously some of us have much, much greater impact than others of us on this planet.
And technology is the next one. You say the development of technologies magnifies the per capita impact of all 7 billion plus of us.
Yes, absolutely. Though I think one of the things that's important to realize, for better or worse, is we've been at this project. I mean, one of the points of the book, we've been at this project of changing the world and of altering the relationships in the world for a very long time, with some technologies that we would consider to be extremely primitive now, our very distant ancestors who, for example, arrived in Australia almost 50,000 years ago, arrived in North America, and somewhat disputed when exactly they arrived in North America, but they did not have very sophisticated weaponry, but they seem to have managed to wipe out most of the large, land animals that they found when they arrived on these new continents, and that was just with some pretty unsophisticated technology. Now we obviously have much, much more sophisticated technologies, and I think one of the big points to make is we are no longer just impacting the world directly by, throwing a spear at something, but we are in the process of very dramatically changing the atmosphere. We're very dramatically changing the chemistry of the oceans. So those are activities that have taken us into a whole new realm.
And then when we get to arrogance as a human characteristic in this, sort of an ideology that rewards short-term thinking without considering the long-term costs or the consequences of the choices that we've made over time, and not just the present society, but all the societies previous to ours.
Yes, it's really a very interesting, one of the points I hope comes through in the book is we live in this really, really interesting moment, which is not necessarily, interesting times are not necessarily what you want to live in, but where we are increasingly have the increasing ability to predict what the outcome of our actions is going to be. Our science and our technologies are so sophisticated. And yet, even when we make some pretty dire predictions, and scientists are out there all the time sounding the alarm, we just had a new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change saying we need to change our ways, not now, really yesterday, to be honest. We don't seem to get a response. So what is it about the human mind where we are capable of building these, incredibly sophisticated technologies, these incredibly sophisticated societies, and not capable of heeding the warnings that were given as a result of that?
We like to believe that man has lived in harmony with nature for most of our time on Earth, and actually you have a different view of that.
Yes, I came to I don't want to say feel. I mean, I think that the research is pretty conclusive on this at this point, and that gets back to the point I was making before, which is that when people started to spread out of Africa and into new continents, and especially this becomes especially apparent when people arrived on islands, you can trace, when you go around the world and you trace human migrations and you come to this point where this new species is, Homo sapiens arrived in a new place, and there are waves of extinctions that resulted just about everywhere that they went, pretty dramatic ones. And as I say, those are particularly obvious when you go to an island. For example, people did not arrive on New Zealand until, maybe 800 years ago, let's say. And New Zealand at that point was inhabited, it had this very interesting fauna, where the dominant animals were birds, moa, these giant birds that grew to be up to, 12 feet tall. There were 9 species of them. And within about a century or so, all the moa were gone. So that's a pretty compelling example of how, even, as I say, people who were armed with pretty unsophisticated technologies really wreaked havoc. And the other thing that happened when people arrived in New Zealand and on many other islands and archipelagos is they brought with them animals like rats. These islands had no mammalian predators often, and the rats just went wild.
I was struck by a scene early in the film Noah, with Russell Crowe as Noah, this epic film. He's out foraging with his children, foraging for food. He's not conducting any agriculture. He's not hunting. He seems to be almost a pacifist when it comes to the idea of hunting wild animals to eat. They're foraging for berries, I think, and any plant food that they can find. And he mildly scolds a child for picking a flower for the child's amusement. And I was just so struck by that because the rest of the landscape in this particular scene is a dystopian. You know, it's a failed society. It's the end of time coming. But here's man. Here's at least the portrayal of a man trying to live in such harmony with nature that he would only take what he needs for himself and his family, and not anything from nature for his own pleasure or entertainment.
Well, you know, I haven't seen Noah yet, but I really have to see it because people have told me it's quite relevant to the story that I'm trying to tell. And I think one point I guess I'd like to make is, you know, we like to moralize our history. We always have, for example. So, you know, one tale that is told is people did live in harmony with nature, you know, and if only we could sort of, you know, go back to that, there would be this sort of Edenic, you know, the, a lot of our creation myths, when you think about it, have to do with our relationship to nature. And I think that we need to sort of transcend that, if that makes sense. It wasn't like our ancestors, because they came through and they brought rats, they didn't do that consciously, and they weren't evil. They were no more or less evil, really, to be honest, than we are. It's just that our actions tend to have unintended consequences. We are a very, very unusual creature in that we're so clever. We can cross water. We can go after prey that's much bigger than ourselves. I mean, if you think about it, just, you know, a spear is quite a dramatic development in evolutionary history. It allows you to go after prey that's bigger, faster, fiercer than you are. And really, when you think about it, if you don't have that, if you don't have those kinds of tools, obviously, as a predator, you're very, very limited. Humans would have been much, much more limited in what they could have gone after.
But now people say, well, we dominate the planet. We're the smartest animals on the planet. We've learned to grow food. We've learned to raise livestock for meat to feed ourselves. What's the big concern here?
Well, all of those things are true, and you know, the question of there's a very profound question which I can't answer, and I don't think anyone can answer at this point, which is, you know, how much of the rest of the planet, of the rest of the other species with whom we share this planet, how much of their habitat, how much of their food sources, how much of the planet can you sort of go through, and if you're smart enough, you know, do okay. And unfortunately, we seem, you know, really set on finding out the answer to that question. And different people different scientists from different disciplines would give you different answers about where that point is. But it's something that I think, you know, you can say we're very smart, and we are very smart, and you can say we have figured out how to grow our own food, and that's certainly true. But we depend on natural systems, obviously, for a lot of our food, you know, our oxygen, our water, all those sorts of things. So, you know, where that line lies, I can't say. I don't think anyone can, but it's not a line you'd want to cross. Let's put it that way.
Well, let me throw this towards you, Elizabeth. Catch it and do what you want with it. Here's a quote from Ronald Reagan. This is Ronald Reagan criticizing the Endangered Species Act in 1977, a quote from he wasn't the president yet. How much do you miss dinosaurs, he asked. Would your life be richer if those giant prehistoric flying lizards occasionally settled on your front lawn? We have contributed to the disappearance of some species by destroying habitat or hunting them down for food, fun, and feathers, but shouldn't we now and then remember nature's part in the elimination of some species and separate the serious from the silly in our own policy? So is that a legitimate question he has?
Wow, that's a great quote. I've never heard that quote before. When you have to hark all the way back to the dinosaurs, you know that you're sort of in an interesting situation. But, you know, I think people definitely, you know, in our daily lives, you know, how many species do we encounter, or how many species are we aware of encountering, you know, our dogs, our cats, our daffodils or whatever. And those are, you know, all domesticated. You know, so much of what we encounter, you know, on our plates and on our, obviously, and just, you know, even taking a walk in the local woods, so much of it has been transported by people, planted by people. It's nothing really resembles very much in most of the U.S., what it would be like before people arrived here, not to mention that, the climate has changed dramatically in that period. But I think that, one point I hope that the book raises is, and gets people thinking about is, the planet isn't just here for us. We are relatively new arrivers. And once again, this gets into some pretty, weighty questions and weighty issues that people, to a certain extent, have to decide for themselves, and societies have to decide. But just the notion that, well, those creatures don't matter because, we don't get anything from them and we don't really care about them. Wow, that's to me a very, very scary thought. I don't really see why people, to be honest, have more of a right to exist than those animals. And the fact that the dinosaurs were done in, 66 million years ago by an asteroid impact, many people would take that as a cautionary tale. The dinosaurs were a very, very successful group of animals. They dominated the planet for way, way, way longer, than we have and than we will. And yet they were gone. So, you can look at that story in several different ways.
Elizabeth Colbert is our guest, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of this book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Elizabeth, we've all heard about carbon, greenhouse gases, and climate change, of course. We've talked about it on this show quite a bit. But one of the most damaging effects of greenhouse gases, and one that most of us probably have never even considered, even though the chemistry is pretty simple, is that carbon emissions are basically turning our oceans into, what's happening here, you refer to this as the evil twin of climate change, the acidification of our oceans. I think we should spend a little time here talking about that.
Yeah, I'm really glad you raised that because it is a very underappreciated and, really, really dramatic change. And if you talk to, geologists and paleontologists even, they will, and marine biologists certainly, they will tell you that this is potentially even more devastating, than climate change. What happens when we burn gasoline or coal or natural gas, we put carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere, and the oceans just cover a very large proportion of the Earth's surface, about 70%. And wherever those two surfaces interact, so the atmosphere and the water, you dissolve gases in the oceans. And if you're pumping CO2 into the atmosphere the way we are, you're effectively pumping it into the ocean. So the oceans are absorbing, let's say, about a third of the CO2 that we put up there. And when you dissolve CO2 in water, you get an acid. That's, just a fact. It's not debatable at all. And we know that we have already changed the acidity of the oceans quite dramatically. We're making them more and more acidic. They're not acidic. They're supposed to be quite alkaline, actually. But the pH is dropping for people who remember their high school chemistry, and it's dropping very fast in a sort of historical sense. The pH of the ocean should be very, very stable and has been very stable over very long times. And one of the effects that we know that this has, once again, from some pretty simple chemistry, is it makes it more difficult for organisms that build shells or these external skeletons out of the mineral calcium carbonate. So anyone who, has picked up a clamshell or a piece of coral on a coral beach, that's calcium carbonate. And you make it harder for those animals, and in some cases plants, to do what they need to do, you're going to be very dramatically changing the makeup of the ocean. So, for example, coral reefs are in trouble. They're in trouble for a lot of reasons, but ultimately, what may really finish them off is the way we're changing the chemistry of the oceans.
You've done quite a bit of traveling for this book. Research for this took 4 years, four continents. Among your travels, places that you visited, the Great Barrier Reef of Australia. Tell us what's happening there that you've noticed.
Yeah, the Great Barrier Reef of Australia is the world's largest reef. It stretches for much of the sort of east coast of off the east coast of Australia for something like 1,500 miles. It's not continuous, but sort of discontinuously. And it's a magnificent place, as anyone who's ever been there will tell you. It's just a fantastic place when you look down onto the reef. There are, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of species that depend on the reef. These incredibly colorful fish, and, you see fish and huge turtles and wonderfully colored corals and these great starfish that are all sorts of different colors in this great shimmering world of life that really doesn't have an analog on land. You just never see so much life, even in a rainforest. So it's an amazing, amazing place. The Great Barrier Reef has lost approximately half of its coral cover just in the last 30 years. So that's a very, very sobering figure. And there are many scientists out there doing experiments on the reef trying to predict the future. And the sort of general consensus is that if we continue on this path that we're on of CO2 emissions, between acidifying the oceans and raising the temperature of the water, which corals don't like either, you could see the Great Barrier Reef basically start to disintegrate around the middle of this century. So this amazing, amazing ecosystem will essentially go belly up.
How did you feel when you were there, when you heard this story, when you talked to the scientists and researchers about that particular place on the globe?
Well, I think it's absolutely, heartbreaking. And I think anyone who's been there and studied it, I think they're all very, very, it's one of those situations where you're in this amazing place, a place almost, really, I would argue, without equal on the planet, just a place I would love to go back to. And yet, everyone there is in this kind of state of pretty high level, depression over what they see as the fate of the reef, and trying to draw people's attention to it, to minimize the impacts, which, as I say, have already been very, very great, and not feeling like they're getting anywhere.
Elizabeth Colbert is our guest in this hour of midday on WYPR. Dan Roderick's here. More with the staff writer for New Yorker when we get back. Her book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, available from Henry Holt & Company, the publisher. A short break on midday, and then we'll talk some more. And Dan Roderick's here on the midday show with Elizabeth Colbert from The New Yorker. Her book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. The title refers to five geological periods defined by natural mass extinctions that significantly reduced the diversity of life on Earth, and the sixth, which is man-made and going on now. Elizabeth, I think we ought to talk about some of the species, the animals that you write about in the book that are going extinct. Some other examples, we mentioned what's happening at the Great Barrier Reef. And by the way, I note there, in terms of the acidification of the oceans, some scientists say that the tipping point when the ocean's ecosystems begin to crash could occur as soon as the year 2100. And, I know you want to provide facts here. I can't help but ask you about how you feel about these things, because I pondered those questions myself, being a father, children growing up in this world, in this country, and wondering what things are going to be like just, 40 or 50 years from now. We seem to be doing so much damage so quickly.
Well, I think it should be, the top of every parent's agenda, to be honest. We spend a lot of time worrying about our kids, and I fear that we're not worrying about things the right way, that our priorities are, how much time do we spend worrying about their SAT scores, and how much time do we spend worrying about, whether we're going to be leaving them a habitable planet? Those are, the latter seems kind of more significant.
Yeah, same here. Let's go up to your neck of the woods. You're up in Massachusetts in the western part of the state. I want to just go over to Vermont a little bit and talk about an example of something you found there that's troubling. Bats in a cave. Why do we care about the bats in a cave? Well, I don't ponder why. But what's happening to the bats in these caves in Vermont?
Yeah, well, I want to say that is really relevant to your listening area too. This is a fungal disease. Here's what happened. About 6 years ago, scientists right around Albany, New York, which is just a little bit west of where I'm standing right now, in the very, very western part of Massachusetts, they noticed, they went to the bats in the Northeast, hibernate, right, over the winter. Those that stay here, they find a place where the temperature is going to be pretty stable, the humidity is going to be pretty stable. That's usually a cave or a mine shaft sometimes, and they hang by their toes, and they go in their body temperature drops to the ambient temperature, their immune system shuts down, and they just hang there all winter. And they have very little fat reserves to live on, so they're really living at the edge for the winter. They've got to get through the winter on this minuscule amount of energy. And what happened is that they went out to do these routine bat sort of checkups in the middle of the winter, and they found dead bats all over at this bat cave. And they didn't know what it was. And then spring arrived, the bats departed, they didn't know what was going on. The next winter comes along, the same thing happens. They find, you know, just this carnage in these bat hibernacula, where bats are hibernating. And it's eventually discovered pretty quickly, because we have pretty sophisticated techniques now, that this is a fungus that is somehow irritating the bats. The fungus sort of eats away at their skin. They wake up, they don't have enough fat to be flying around. There's no food for them, obviously, in the middle of winter, and they drop dead. And this is now, this fungal disease is been traced back to Europe. It was probably brought over inadvertently, completely inadvertently, by, you know, some tourist or somebody who went into a cave where there were bats. And now it has spread to at least 22 states. I just recently read that it had been found in a couple more, so that number might even be out of date. And it's in 5 Canadian provinces. I'm sure it's down in Maryland. I'm quite sure of that.
It is in Western Maryland, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it has killed millions and millions of bats. It's very, it's probably noticeable if you're somebody who, you know, is out in a place where bats used to hover, for example, over a pond. Very common bats, the little brown bat, the most common bat in the U.S. You would notice that you see many fewer bats now than you used to, because so many of them have been killed by this fungal disease. And that is an instance where people brought together, you know, these creatures, this fungus and these bats, who had never encountered each other before and were used to be separated by an ocean. And when they did, just for freakish reasons that no one could have predicted, terrible things happened.
Right. So what we draw from that is a couple of things. First, that man is able to do this. We're able to straddle continents, jump from one to the other, and you know, introduce all kinds of invasive phenomena or species. And then the other part of this is the balance. It gets back to our how we're upsetting the natural balance of things. Bats. Some people shriek when they see bats, but of course, bats are great. Bats eat a lot of insects. Bats do their job. They take part in this vast ecosystem of ours.
Yes, exactly. And you know, what's the impact going to be of, you know, losing? I mean, I wouldn't say that the little brown bat is going extinct, but its population is way down here in New England, certainly. So losing, as you say, a pretty key player in the ecosystem, very common animal, you know, it's sort of like, you know, not, it's sort of comparable to losing, you know, squirrels or whatever. You know, what's the impact that is going to have? And it's very hard to know.
You traveled to Panama, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Panamanian golden frogs and why you cite them in your book.
Well, I really sort of got into this whole topic because I got interested in what's known as the amphibian crisis. So amphibians are frogs and toads and salamanders, basically. And they're a very, very hardy group. They've been around for a really long time, a couple hundred million years. And suddenly, in the late 80s, people started to realize that they were losing frogs and toads. They were losing populations that people had known about forever, and then they were losing species. And people for a while couldn't figure out what was going on, because one thing that was really weird about it is that they were seeing these crashes both in sort of populated areas and also in pretty unpopulated, pretty remote areas. You go to a remote area and you'd find no more frogs. So it was pretty freakish, and it also turned out to be a fungal disease that was carried around the world, almost certainly by people carrying amphibians around the world. And there are a couple of theories of how that happened. And that is what really got me started on this, because amphibians, something like 40% of all amphibians are classified as threatened right now. They are the most threatened group of animals in the world, and many, many spectacular species, these beautiful brightly colored species from Central America have been lost, and one of these is the Panamanian a golden frog, which is actually technically a toad. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful sort of bright yellow, neon yellow frog, very poisonous, actually, and it exists now only in these super biosecure facilities, one in Panama, maybe a couple in Panama, a couple at zoos, some zoos in the U.S., but it no longer can be found in the wild.
Wow. If it wasn't for that effort and that disinfected and that monitored building that you're talking about there, then that species would have disappeared fairly quickly.
Yes, absolutely. People watched this scourge, I guess, just race through Panama. It's now, I think, throughout the country from one end, jumped over the Panama Canal. It's in many, many places. I just recently read a paper that someone published that it has arrived in Madagascar, which has a really interesting and unique set of amphibians. Madagascar is sort of one of these islands that has its completely own fauna, very interesting evolutionary history. And so that's really scary, too, that you have a new place that's being infected.
There's one more species story I want to ask you to relate to our audience, Elizabeth. There are several fascinating ones in your book, and some a little bit on the bizarre side. Efforts to keep these species going, like that one in Panama, but this one, the Hawaiian crow, I think this... If you don't mind relating this story.
Sure, yeah. That's a story that ends the book, so you have to get all the way to the end of the book. I hate to give away the ending.
Oh, well,
but
if you can tease it a little bit.
Okay, yeah, no, that's okay. This is a story of a Hawaiian crow. And Hawaiian crows are, they look a lot like crows that you find on the mainland, but they're their own distinct species, and that's one of these really interesting cases where somehow crows got to Hawaii, right, which is really remote, 3,000 miles of open water or something like that, and then managed to, reproduce and found a new species, basically. And there were actually several species of Hawaiian crows at some point, but they seem to have been mostly wiped out when the first Polynesians arrived. But when the Europeans arrived, there was one species left. It's known as the alala. And this species is also in terrible, terrible trouble. And in the 90s, people realized that, in fact, it's extinct in the wild at this point, just like the Panamanian golden frog. But people also had the foresight to bring some of them into captivity to try to breed them on the island of Maui. And this particular bird, by the name of Kanoe that you're referring to, he has some very important genetic material that he doesn't think of himself as a bird. He seems to have self-identity problems. And he refused to mate with any of the female birds at this breeding facility. So they brought him to the San Diego Zoo to see if they could get him to, let's just say, part with some of his genetic material. And that involved a woman there who's a reproductive physiologist, a PhD, a very, very eminent scientist, taking Kanoe on her lap several times a week during breeding season and stroking him in a way that male crows are supposed to find very, very erotic. Yeah. And she is hoping to get some semen from him that she could then take to Maui to artificially inseminate some of the birds there. But when I was there, which was about a year ago, he had not come through yet. Let's just put it that way.
Some people criticize the time, effort, and the money that goes into the, efforts like that, into saving relatively small-scale species. So how do you feel when you hear people say that?
Well, I think that the effort, and I detail a couple of efforts like this where I think that they're really, admirable on a lot of levels, and people have devoted their lives to these species, most of which, turn out to be, each species is has its own habits, and you have to learn that, and you're learning that, even as the species is winking out, and it's really a race against time in many cases. And I think that the people who are involved with them would say, there's something heroic and there's something tragic and there's something crazy about this situation that we're in, where very, very smart people, are devoting their lives to things like, stroking crows, that's mm-hmm. the only way to try to perpetuate this species, which has been driven to the very, very brink of oblivion? And, you know, don't we need to sort of think in a much, much bigger, more holistic way? But on the other hand, you know, on some level you could say, we can't, we're right in the midst of this, and you have to try to save these species, you know, that are on the brink right now. We can't really wait for these more holistic approaches. And so both are true, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, Elizabeth Colbert, you certainly have done your part in raising awareness about these grand issues that face life on Earth. But, you know, there are people still resistant to the idea that climate change is man-made, that this phenomena is actually occurring. They may look at your book and think of it as being unnecessarily alarmist. But, you know, my perception is that that's becoming, at least in the United States, more of a minority view. However, when you're talking about 7+ billion people around the globe, how do you push it? How do you get to the tipping point where we say, oh, we've made, you know, inflicted too much damage. We've got to get ourselves under control here as humans, or this mass extinction will be inevitable.
You know, I don't have the answer to that, and I wrote the book, you know, very much to get people thinking about this, and mm-hmm. I wrote it. I tried to write it. It doesn't matter what your politics are. You know, these are stories of things that are happening on the ground, scientists working, you know, on the ground. Their politics are irrelevant. In some cases, I don't even know what their politics are. It really is a story that, you know, completely transcends politics. And I'm hoping that people of all political persuasions will read it, because, you know, definitely this needs, you know, full participation and full awareness. But the question of, even if you got to, you know, full awareness and people, you know, saying, okay, yes, we agree, we really ought to be doing something. The question of what we ought to be doing is such a huge question. There are so many ways, as we've discussed, you know, just in this last hour, that we're acidifying the oceans, we're changing the climate, we're moving species around the planet, we're mowing down habitat. These all, unfortunately, have to be addressed, and that is a very, very tall order.
Do you see any bright spots, any place where we might be winning the war against mass extinction, the sixth extinction?
Well, I think one bright spot that I did see was, you know, in the Amazon. And now I was only in the Amazon once, so I don't want to really claim to have seen it. But I think that attention was brought to the very rapid destruction of the Amazon, which is a huge sort of cradle for, you know, many, many species, you know, one of the great, you know, diversity spots of the world. And I think that has been taken pretty seriously by the Brazilian government. It's not, you know, they're by no means perfect, but the rate at which we're losing that rainforest has really slowed and from some very, very concerted efforts. And I think that shows you, and that, you know, Brazil is a country that's developing very rapidly, you know, a lot of people living in poverty. And that shows you, to a certain extent, what can be done, even, you know, in a country that's much less rich, you know, than the U.S. So it should serve as sort of an inspiration to us who live in the developed world, you know, that we really ought to be taking taking this a lot more seriously too, and putting a lot more resources into it.
If extinction is a morbid topic, mass extinction is, well, massively so. It's also a fascinating one. So writes Elizabeth Colbert in her book, The Sixth Extinction, and she pretty much delivers on that premise. It's a highly readable and often entertaining book, a look at a very serious subject. And Elizabeth Colbert, we thank you for your time today and your book. Thank you for being on Midday.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker. Again, her book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, is published by Henry Holt. That's the first hour of Midday. We take a break now for lunch, brought to us every Thursday by The Veranda, located in Hamden on 36th Street, serving home-style Indian food, specializing in flatbread and chaat. The Veranda, now open 7 days a week for lunch, 11:30 to 4 p.m. Please stay tuned for the news, and we'll see you for the second hour of our show.